You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Relax and enjoy these encore readings as we await the March issue. Here's the continuation of Regrets Only by Maureen O'Connor. Life has come full circle. I've finally been attacked for nothing more than being Jewish, or being a woman, or being at the wrong place at the wrong time. 3 days later, Variety reported that three studios had distanced themselves from her. FX had worked with Siegel, but Variety reported that it was highly unlikely they'd hire her again. Annapurna dismissed Siegel from work on Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Siegel says, technically, she had not yet been hired. Two events for Netflix's Ryan Murphy TV show The Politician were already in the works. Siegel's name was removed from invitations that had not yet been sent. All told, Siegel believes that in less than a week, she lost around 10 jobs. An executive who had previously retained Siegel told me about calling his peers about her at the time. Your gut is saying, there's no way we're going to associate our movie with her. But it's a gut check. There's no reason to risk outraged guest when you could just as easily hire one of Siegel's competitors. An unforced error on an Oscar campaign is stupid, said the executive. I sent, 100 emails to every marketing person, every publicity person, everyone that had done business with me over the past 25, 30 years, said Siegel, who has landed only one paying job since. This was the universal excuse. The corporate lawyers would not allow us to hire you because we are a publicly held company and we cannot endanger the reputation of our publicly held company with anyone that is associated with Jeffrey Epstein, she said. I finally turned to a lawyer and said, "Who are these people?" Siegel continued, and the lawyer said, "Nobody. It's just an expression." Next photo, all that glittered. Cate Blanchett and Siegel at a Chanel event at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, 2015. Let us briefly state the obvious. Peggy Siegel would rather not be sitting in her new attorney's apartment on Central Park South, giving me the blow-by-blow of her ostensible professional death. As a publicist, Siegel knows that image is everything. Revealing that her company is collapsing, she's laid off 8 employees and is down to just 1 assistant, could be what ends it. That's why, in the last 6 months, Siegel says she has informally consulted colleagues, including New York Power publicist Leslie Dart, Cynthia Swartz, and Susie Ahrens, and it's why she would converse on the record only in the presence of Burt Fields, a 90-year-old showbiz lawyer whose clients have included Tom Cruise and the Beatles. Fields hosted our interviews in his 12th-floor dining room. In another room, Fields' wife, the art consultant Barbara Guggenheim, took phone calls. Siegel remains conflicted about whether participating in this article will save her or destroy her, but she also believes that her account is her best shot at keeping the lights on the Peggy Siegel Company. Until you or I or anybody else can get the truth out that I have been unjustly accused as a woman, then I have no business, she said. I go out 7 nights a week. I have an apartment on the Upper East Side. I have no family. My life is my work. It's always been that way. The first time we met, Siegel was brittle. She cycled through what felt like the whole spectrum of human emotions. She ranted, lamented, pounded the table, cracked jokes, grew teary-eyed, reviewed movies, and praised her friends. The second time, she was in better spirits. Her hair was curled, and she'd come from a City Meals on Wheels luncheon honoring Wendy Ding Murdoch. She wore a rib-knit sweater tucked into a voluminous tweed skirt. Her appearance was as youthful as I'd been led to believe. Siegel has celebrated birthdays by distributing guidebooks to aging. Most recently, How to Look Like Me at 70, that feature her favorite plastic surgeon and beauticians. Listings include the best toe reductions, my third set of veneers, a new neck, and a newer neck. I used to be a powerful woman, but now I just go to lunch with other powerful women, Siegel announced, displaying the event's program. Next photo, off the table, Siegel speaks to Anne Hathaway at a New York City Ballet Gala celebrating Valentino, 2012. For the record, here is Peggy Siegel's Jeffrey Epstein story, according to Peggy Siegel. She no longer remembers when she met Epstein. A statement released in July indicated the year is 2005. Siegel told me she does not recall making that statement. In 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty to soliciting a 16-year-old for sex after an investigation that began with a complaint from a 14-year-old. Siegel says she knew he served time for something in 2008, but can't remember whether she knew he pleaded guilty to soliciting sex with a minor. I had no idea about the underage girls, she said. She knew that his prison sentence was part-time. Epstein served 13 months in Palm Beach County Jail with work releases that allowed him to leave for 12 hours a day. He returned to New York in 2010. I'm sure I had said something like, "You better change your ways," Siegel said. I mean, I knew him, but I didn't know much about him. Yeah, I spoke to him on the phone. He came to some screenings. I was never privy to his private life. I knew nothing about the girls, nothing at all. In the July statement, released through McKenna, Siegel said she and Epstein were social friends. She defined the term for me. I can call them on the phone. They can call me. I can send him an invitation without being embarrassed because it's not a cold invitation. I can greet them at the door. I can talk to them after the movie. To believe Siegel had no idea about the girls requires some credulity. Before and after Epstein's guilty plea, Siegel spoke glowingly of him in articles that described his alleged crimes and the ages of his victims. Either she didn't read those articles, or she didn't absorb much of the information above and below her name. A 2011 story about Prince Andrew's 2010 visit to Epstein, during which Siegel played host, appeared on the front page of the New York Post with the headline Prince and Perv. News coverage at the time of the visit was thorough and straightforward. The prince's ex-wife, the Duchess of York, clarified that she abhors pedophilia. It's so much easier in hindsight, 10 years later, to digest all this information and say, well, of course they knew that, Siegel said. The times have changed so much in the past 5 years that which was normal bad behavior between genders is completely out of the realm of possibility today. Gossip columnist George Rush, then of the New York Daily News, remembers speaking to Siegel about Epstein while his original criminal charges were pending. I don't know whether that was willful blindness or she really just didn't take the time to find out, Rush said, of the accusations against Epstein. Sitting at Burt Field's table, Siegel did her best to explain how Epstein hid in plain sight in her social circle. But to understand how Epstein fits in, Siegel said, I would have to understand the life of a woman who built her career before hashtag MeToo. In subsequent weeks, She devoted herself to self-explanation, sometimes calling and emailing daily. On Thanksgiving, she sent a soul-searching 1,200-word email that used the story of the holiday as a parable for her plight. A legendary dinner party that, in retrospect, masked a much darker reality. "The men are fine," she said, referring to Epstein associates such as Gates, Wexner, and Leon Black. "They're moving on with their billions and their jets and their families and their businesses. It's just odd that a single woman who's done nothing but kill herself for filmmakers has had to suffer like this. It's completely unfair. I am a publicist in the perception business, and I have been a victim of perception," she said. Siegel grew up in a Polish-Jewish family in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. She landed her first job at 16 as a showroom model for 7th Avenue dress company Susie Perrette. "All day long, I put the dresses on and took the dresses off and twirled around the showroom," she said. To understand her childhood, Siegel instructed me to watch the 1969 film adaptation of Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus, starring Ally McGraw as a Jewish-American princess. Her conversations are peppered with such suggestions, underscoring what the director Barry Levinson described as her honest enthusiasm for film. Her father's family owned a light bulb factory that resembled a scene from Norma Rae. Their family in Poland, all of whom died in the Holocaust, had a foundry exactly like the factory in Schindler's List. She is absolutely, compulsively, and dedicatedly interested in movies and show business, said actor and producer Bob Balaban, who has known Siegel for 40 years. And royalty, basically, but really movies. Siegel's mother raised her to believe you'll go to college, you'll work for a year or two, you'll design a few dresses, and then you'll get married. After attending Syracuse University, she moved to New York to pursue a career in fashion, at one point designing her own accessories line. Then she met publicist Bobby Zarum and went to work for him. She hung out at Elaine's and delivered society news to gossip columnist Eileen Meal. She studied New York society and the overlapping galaxies within it. Film, fashion, art, finance, each swirled alongside the others, interacting and colliding daily to shift the city's center of gravity one way or the other. After Zarum, she worked for the publicist Lois Smith. Her first two clients were Billie Jean King, adored me, and Liza Minnelli, hated me on sight. Film became Siegel's specialty. She worked on E.T. in 1982, moved to Los Angeles to work for Steven Spielberg, then came home to New York to launch a PR firm with Smith as her partner. Their first film was The Big Chill, which opened the New York Film Festival in 1983 and earned 3 Oscar nominations. Smith left Siegel in the mid-80s, and Siegel distinguished her business by leaning into events. She specialized in salon-style film screenings that brought together influential people from different social universes. Discussions of Siegel's power invariably revolve around her list, a database of tens of thousands of potential party guests categorized by the power tribes to which they belong: media, finance, actors, producers, and, of course, voting members of the Academy. She performed a sort of analog version of social media, encouraging influential people to influence one another. "She's come up with this thing where she curates events and interesting host committees," said Balaban. "For instance, she might have well-known bankers or business journalist host a screening of a movie like Wall Street or The Big Short. Guest at a 2015 event for Levinson's Rock the Casbah included Bruce Springsteen, Paul McCartney, John Bon Jovi, John Mellencamp, Jimmy Buffett, Jan Wenner, and Bill Clinton. As Siegel likes to say, the mix is the message. When Oscar campaigning emerged as a multi-million-dollar sub-industry in the 1990s, Harvey Weinstein led the way, and Siegel, and much of Hollywood, adopted his laser focus on appealing to voting members of the Academy. Siegel tailored her events to appeal to members of the Academy, earning more business and sway along the way. "She's a bulldog, or better, a dog with a bone," said Rain Man producer Mark Johnson. "If you couldn't make a screening, and you couldn't make the next one, it became too difficult to keep saying no to her, because she would just put such guilt on you." "The fact that she gets under people's skin is kind of why she's great to work with," said a different producer, arguing that publicity favors the bold. Chuckling, the producer described Siegel's annual tradition of arriving at the Oscars red carpet hours before the ceremony begins so she can greet and photobomb celebrities. In 2016, she hid on the floor of actor Alicia Vikander's SUV to sneak into Guy O'Ciri's Oscar party, from which she'd been banned 2 years prior. For the sin of being a publicist, she said. She later documented the feat in her Oscar diary for Avenue magazine. Not everyone finds Siegel's aggression charming. Many describe her as brusque. She has been known to berate her staff, others' staffs, chauffeurs, assistants, and defiant guests. "She rules with access and fear," said a professional contact who has experienced both. Her singular focus on A-listers comes at the expense of those she deems unworthy of her attention. "This is one of the reasons why people would think I'm a terrible person," said Siegel. She says she knows every name that has appeared in Page Six in the last 4 months and Vogue in the last year, but doesn't always know the names of her employees. "Sometimes I put a little sign by my desk of all the girls because I'm going, 'This one, this one, this one,'" she explained. "Probably I would be a better person if I had more small talk with them and more empathy for them and cared more about them," she said. "I don't have time because my business is so competitive." She demonstrated what updating her list looks like. "Here, put these guys in the computer," she would say, as an employee typed. "This one's dead. This one's hot. This one is so-and-so's daughter." Star-seeking yielded high-flying friends. A person who knows Siegel described their phone conversations as glitterati mad libs. "Hello, I'm in fabulous location with my dear friend, ultra-rich person, and we're on our way to exclusive event." An abbreviated list of names Siegel dropped in my presence: Barbara Streisand, David Geffen, Gloria Steinem, Andy Warhol, Julian Fellows, Nora Ephron, Calvin Klein, Sienna Miller, Barry Diller, Eddie Murphy, Barbara Walters, Peter Brandt, Mitzi Newhouse, Jerry Bruckheimer, Dolly Sinatra, Queen Elizabeth's third lady-in-waiting, and several people she seemed to think could make or break my career. Locations included Luxor, London, Cannes, St. Bart, Michaels, Studio 54, Mikhail Baryshnikov's apartment building, the owner's box at MetLife Stadium, and the San Vicente bungalows. Owner Jeffrey Klein is a great friend of mine. While Siegel was building her mix, Epstein was building his on a parallel track. He, too, had a reputation as a heat-seeking missile, particularly for scientists and statesmen. By the time he met Siegel, Epstein's social status was snowballing. He had become friendly with so many socially desirable people that onlookers assumed he, too, was socially desirable. Bill Gates sort of normalized it, said New York publicist R. Curry Hay, who says he considered but decided against taking Epstein on as a client. Because you figure Bill Gates can meet him and be his friend for 2 or 3 years, so why can't you? He was a very minor aspect of the mix, Siegel said of Epstein. He was one of thousands that came through, and in the billionaire level, hundreds of. He was nothing really special, except he was another wise guy billionaire. She paused. Or said he was a billionaire. Court records document Epstein's assets at $550 million. By 2007, as the Palm Beach investigation was playing out, Epstein's profile was expanding. For a New York Magazine article that year, journalist Philip Weiss met with Epstein in the office of Manhattan PR heavyweight Howard Rubenstein, who has represented Rupert Murdoch, Leona Helmsley, and Mount Sinai Hospital. A spokesperson for Rubenstein's firm says that after Epstein's conviction, the firm dropped him and stopped returning his calls. Titled The Fantasist, the article described the criminal accusations against Epstein, which included using a vibrator on a 14-year-old girl. Siegel is the first Epstein friend quoted in the article, in a paragraph that noted that girl's age. 2 months later, Epstein surfaced at another Siegel event. He returned to Florida to plead guilty later that year. No matter what it said in the paper, that was irrelevant to the fact that he wasn't in the jail, Siegel says in defense of her overall proximity to Epstein. So how serious would you think that was? The New York story provides a window into how Epstein's social circle might have understood his crimes at the time. The article presented a theory that Epstein viewed and passed off his lechery as a version of the libidinous lifestyles that made men like Bob Guccione and Hugh Hefner famous a generation earlier. Weiss ultimately paints an entirely monstrous vision of Epstein, but his early pitch to his subject was, it's the Icarus story, someone who flies too close to the sun, as if sexual contact with minors was a symptom of overambition. Epstein's instantly infamous response, did Icarus like massages? I ask a different journalist, who ran in Siegel's social circle at the time, whether the ages of Epstein's alleged victims were common knowledge. I think it was generally known, the journalist said, but it was like, oh wow, you got away with it. Wow, good for you. There was a whole group of guys that were bad boys that had very bad reputations, Siegel told me. They used to be called playboys, and my relationship with them was not about their social lives. I had a business to run. If they had legitimate social clout and could make a difference and pass along a good word about these films, they were included in these events. I didn't have time to get involved with the social lives of these guys. More than one Siegel friend made a similar, if backhanded, argument. Peggy was too self-interested to enable Epstein. You know about the Golden Rule? Siegel asked me during a discussion of men who abuse their power. Do unto others? No. Those who have the gold, rule. When Epstein returned to New York in August 2010, reporters noted his presence at a Siegel screening of Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps. The guest list included Steve Mnuchin, Wilbur Ross, Rudy Giuliani, and the late shopping mall magnate Alfred Taubman. The scene prompted one observer to joke to the Wall Street Journal about the beautifully done meeting of the prosecutor and the felon. To be fair, they could have been talking about Taubman, who served time for violating price-fixing laws. Epstein's presence at Siegel events, or seemingly on her arm, periodically drew attention. The Hollywood Reporter dated its last such sighting to 2016. Siegel told the paper that Epstein had sometimes been a last-minute guest list addition, in which case his name wouldn't have appeared on the studio-approved list. During Epstein's second month back in New York, Siegel attended a post-Yom Kippur break fast at Epstein's home. The Daily Beast, Alexandra Wolf, reported that a group of 120 friends brought their children over. Siegel said she recalled only that the event was a serious religious gathering. Then there was the dinner for Prince Andrew. On the day of the party, in December 2010, Siegel said Epstein called to request her help. "And I'm like," she fell into a hushed tone, "Prince Andrew? Yeah, I could do that. When is it?" "Tonight," said Epstein. "I thought it was strange," Siegel said, "that someone who actually had a prince in his house as a house guest couldn't figure out a few people to invite for dinner. I thought that was odd. On the other hand, I had my own selfish reasons because I wanted to tell Andrew about the king's speech. She was promoting the film, which later won Best Picture. Its distributor was the Weinstein Company. Prince William and Kate Middleton's wedding was coming up, so Siegel called three journalists, Katie Couric, George Stephanopoulos, and Charlie Rose. She also invited Chelsea Handler, Woody Allen, and Soon-Yi Previn. I said, 'There's this guy, Jeffrey Epstein. He has a huge house. It's really beautiful. It's one of the largest houses in New York, and he's a financier. And he was hosting a dinner for Prince Andrew.' In the July Times article, Handler said, 'It was just one of those strange nights.' Stephanopoulos described his attendance as a mistake." Siegel said Prince Andrew was incredibly polite, but would not comment on his interactions with Epstein. Then she asked me if I'd watched the third season of The Crown, which she recently binged. "Peter Morgan is a genius," she said. The New York Post published its Prince and Perv cover 2 months after the Duke's visit, prompting the Duchess of York to issue her statement abhorring pedophilia and to apologize for accepting money from Epstein. Around that time, Epstein hired another publicist, Los Angeles crisis manager Michael Citrick, who has represented R. Kelly, Harvey Weinstein, and Theranos. Citrick said that, knowing what he knows now, he would not accept Epstein as a client. He emphasized that his work for Epstein was not a reputation restoration assignment. "He only fielded press requests," he said. "I never met him." Nobody has accused Siegel of enabling Epstein's criminal behavior. Siegel says the dinner party was a favor. Rather, she is accused of enabling Epstein's rarefied social life, which he, in turn, presented to his victims to manipulate them. More than being just a movie screenings guru, she's an important social connector. A New Yorker who has known and observed Siegel for years told me, "And if you're kind of gross and second tier, or if your politics are out of step with the dominant, allegedly progressive ethos of New York, she can do a lot to ameliorate and ease the way. Especially," this person theorized, "if you've got a private plane or a beachfront property." Siegel says she has never been on Epstein's jet or visited his homes in Palm Beach and the Virgin Islands. I ran down a list of rumors and questions about Siegel's relationship with Epstein. Did she see him with girls who appeared to be underage? "No, but it's very hard to tell their ages. You don't walk into a room and say, 'Oh, right, how old are you?'" Did she accept Epstein's financial assistance when she traveled, as she confirmed to The Hollywood Reporter in July? "That's a mistake," Siegel said. "I thought I did, and I went back to the accountant. I never did." How could she confuse that? In my world, people send presents. In my world, people invite you to their homes in the south of France. They invite you on boats. Sometimes they invite you on planes. Did Epstein help her during a legal issue with her brother over her inheritance? "Yes, he gave me help." She would not specify its nature. Did she hire a young woman as an intern in 2018 on Epstein's recommendation? I provided the woman's name. Everybody's friend has a daughter who wants to be an intern. I don't even know their names. Some Epstein accusers have described performing jobs that might have resembled those of a household staff. Did Siegel notice that? You're not supposed to notice the staff. At a recent press conference, a woman who alleged she was 15 when Epstein raped her said, "It was clear from the time I spent with Epstein that something was very wrong with his lifestyle, and it didn't take a victim to see that. We were not hidden." They didn't have to be. To socially ambitious guest whose attention, care, and compassion went in only one direction, up, they would have been invisible. "I didn't have chains," Virginia Roberts Giuffre said in her BBC interview. "These powerful people were my chains." Siegel contemplated whether her admitted inattentiveness is a personal failure. Part of this, I don't know whether guilt is the right word, but remorse, just this nauseous feeling, is that I didn't see it. How did I miss it? I mean, I'm extremely articulate. I am extremely perceptive. I'm in the perception business. And it was right in front of me, and I didn't see it. And it's very hard to believe that, but it's the truth. Epstein hanged himself in his prison cell on August 10th. Siegel does not believe Epstein committed suicide. "Where has the FBI hidden Ghislaine Maxwell?" Siegel asked, throwing up her hands. "I have been destroyed, and Ghislaine Maxwell is probably on some island, sunbathing." Less than a month later, at the film festivals in Telluride and Toronto, Siegel received no invitations to screenings or parties. Before a Jojo Rabbit showing in Toronto, she said a dear friend asked her to avoid the theater, lest her presence damage the reputation of a comedic movie about Hitler. 2 months later, Siegel was uninvited from HBO's premiere of the Ralph Lauren documentary, Very Ralph, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. "These are dear friends of mine, treating me like I have leprosy," said Siegel. To stay busy, Siegel hosted events pro bono for friends. She organized a fundraiser for a South African theater troupe that British director Stephen Daldry supports. She hosted a dinner for her dermatologist, Makrine Alexiades. At the Hamptons International Film Festival in October, she purchased 40 tickets to a screening of the Netflix film The Two Popes, invited a crowd that included 7 voting members of the Academy, and hosted a dinner party at the East Hampton home of billionaire philanthropist Catherine Rayner afterward. If a studio hired Siegel to organize such an event, the bill would be between $20,000 and $25,000, she said. "I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it." Why did Siegel fall so hard, so fast? All of her detractors and many of her boosters brought up her churlishness. "I don't think that Jeffrey really undid her," said the longtime observer. "I think she mistreated people for so long, for so many years, so publicly, so flagrantly, that the minute there was this little thing that nonetheless revealed something bigger about her, everybody pounced. 2 people noted that those who work with her sometimes feel leveraged. She gets the confidence of a fancy director who's being nominated for an Academy Award. Then she gets the director to call the studio and say, 'You have to hire Peggy Siegel.' And they hire Peggy. And they're annoyed," said a producer who believes Epstein provides a convenient excuse for them to avoid her. Some, including Siegel, point to sexism. Matt McKenna said Siegel's gender made her a media target. "That it was a woman who helped Jeffrey Epstein come back? I think that narrative was too seductive for the trades." Several people I spoke to argued that Siegel would not seem so brusque if she were a man, and invoked seemingly unsinkable male Epstein associates such as Wexner and Black. But has gender protected those men, or has their status and wealth? Some men have lost prestigious posts. Joy Ito, director of the MIT Media Lab, resigned after his role soliciting donations from Epstein came to light. MIT computer scientist Richard Stallman stepped down amid controversy over leaked emails discussing a different scientist Epstein-related sexual assault allegation. Prince Andrew may have been forced into early retirement. I think we wonder, are we somehow not giving her the pass that we would give to men? Said the Observer, who thought the scandal revealed Siegel's larger issues. But it's like, no, she's a person who had no issue kind of orchestrating the social reinvention of David Koch and Jeffrey Epstein, this person said, referring to Siegel's relationship with the late billionaire activist. That's a specific person, and sometimes ruthless ambition is loathsome. There are publicists who rehabilitate criminal reputations for a living, a different publicist noted, but Siegel's job is to bring people places. She cultivates an audience. You want to feel good about that person. When the mix is the message, there isn't room for any error in judgment. Hollywood isn't a town known for its vast reserves of loyalty. For her business to be threatened because she invited Jeffrey Epstein to parties is just such bullshit, a producer who is fond of Siegel told me. It's morally reprehensible to take Peggy down because of what Jeffrey Epstein did. Every fiber in my body says that's wrong. He paused. Unless, by the way, have you uncovered more? Meanwhile, the film industry is changing. Intimidating bosses with big personalities aren't tolerated as they once were. As theatrical releases lose their power, so do adjacent traditions such as screenings. And the Academy is changing, too. Under pressure to increase diversity, the group has added thousands of new members in the last few years. Siegel's power base, as she readily admits, is old, white, Jewish men. Their votes still matter, but less than before. She is one of the direct causes of hashtag OscarsSoWhite, said an ex-employee. Can Siegel make a comeback? Several people I spoke to pointed out that only a few months have passed since her PR crisis. Maybe she'll have better luck next year. I have been told to go away, Siegel said. Go away for a year so everybody forgets. Well, I'd like to know where I should go. A fellow publicist observed that Siegel may be her own worst enemy. Is she having a publicity crisis or publicizing a personal crisis? She came up to me at a party and said, "You know, I can't get any work. This whole kind of pity thing," said a person in Siegel's social orbit. "Woe is me. Feel sorry for me." And you know what? I almost did. But there are a lot of much nicer people that this happened to that deserve our sympathy and support. Siegel can talk for hours about being treated unfairly. During our interviews, she went out of the way to name three ex-employees she believes spoke to the press and are poaching her clients, including one she believes stole her list. Ironically, Bobby Zarum has long held that Siegel stole his list. He's 83, working on his memoir in Savannah, Georgia, and still mad. "I did not steal his list," said Siegel. In December, Siegel attended the world premiere of Cats, her first major studio premiere since her fall. It took work. She lobbied NBC Universal Vice Chairman Ron Meyer by email before securing the invitation. Before the movie, she stopped by a cocktail party in the Manhattan home of Greece's exiled crown prince. Across the street from Epstein's townhouse, she observed that the lights were still on. "Why not retire?" I asked Siegel. "Be a full-time lady who lunches." She glanced at Fields, who is 18 years her elder and still goes to the office. "If I would be happy with that, I would have married a dentist 50 years ago and moved to Scarsdale, like Marjorie Morningstar," she said, referring to the 1958 film in which Natalie Wood, in the title role, plays a Jewish-American actor deciding between career and marriage. Defying her mother's vision for her, Siegel never married. At the end of our first sit-down, Siegel asked me to turn my recorder back on. The sun had set during our 2.5-hour interview, prompting Barbara Guggenheim to joke that we looked like we were having a séance. To get that first job as a showroom model, Siegel said, she'd been forced to stand in a bra and slip in front of the store's owner, who came too close, looked at her lasciviously, and touched her shoulder. "I was 16, and that was the first time I experienced fear of a man who I didn't know," she said. When she was 24, Siegel said, she would walk to the factory that manufactured her jewelry line. The truck drivers always used to whistle, and I always used to say hi to them because I wanted to just be so cool. One summer day, she said, one of the whistlers followed her. When she got into the factory building elevator, he jumped in, trapped her, held a knife to her ribs, and demanded to see her breast. He pinned her to the wall. She screamed. He repeated his demand, and she kept screaming as he held the car on an empty floor. "Eventually, he ran off," she said. She broke down and cried. "To this day, I will not stand in an elevator with a single guy," she said. "I never went in a subway again. I took taxicabs every place. I never walked home alone after an event or a movie." She was teary and shaking as she told me this. At our next sit-down, Siegel was more composed as she discussed Epstein's victims. "The idea of these women, what he did to those women, is so incomprehensible to me," she said. "To be a part of this, and to be accused of being part of this, it's so humiliating. I keep thinking, what did I do to deserve this?" she said. "And then I say, nothing."
Thank you.
Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Pedro Almodovar, the director of Pain and Glory, talks samba and social justice. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A sudden summer breeze on a hot afternoon? Which historical figure do you most identify with? Federico Garcia Lorca. Which living person do you most admire? Dr. Pedro Cavadas, a pioneer in face transplants and a specialist in the transplant of severed members. This surgeon from Valencia devotes his summer breaks to travel to Africa and tend to children who have been castrated in tribal conflicts. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Sincerity in its most brutal version. It isn't always necessary. On what occasion do you lie? The few times I go to a movie premiere or to a theater opening in the artist dressing rooms. Which living person do you most despise? I don't despise, I prefer to hate. And I hate Trump. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? In Spanish, no doy crédito. I cannot believe my eyes. In English, I usually abuse, actually. What is your greatest regret? If I make a mistake, I try to apologize. But regret is an imposition from my Catholic childhood that I refuse. When and where were you happiest? The first time I went into a samba school in Rio de Janeiro, the whole neighborhood was rehearsing in plain clothes the numbers they'd performed during the carnival. Which talent would you most like to have? To be a great novelist. What is your current state of mind? I miss my youth. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? You have to accept family the way it is. What is your most treasured possession? Memories. Materially speaking, 18 of the 21 films I have directed. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? All miseries are unfair and unbearable, but migrants running away from war and slavery only to find first world doors closed seems intolerable to me. The other side of this problem is people condemned to unalleviated poverty in the first world, which seems horrible to me too. Where would you like to live? For the time being, in Madrid, where I feel most comfortable and organized. What is your favorite occupation? To rewrite, when I have the story for a script clear and defined. What is your most marked characteristic? I never give up. What is the quality you most like in a man? Originality and lack of prejudices. What is the quality you most like in a woman? The capacity to fight. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Don Quixote. Who are your heroes in real life? The ONG Open Arms, whose members risk their lives and freedom to save migrants from drowning in the Mediterranean Sea. What are your favorite names? Antonio, Carmen, Soledad, Eurydice, and Faye. Faith. How would you like to die? Like John Huston, after shooting the dead. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Pedro Almodovar.
Thank you.
Vanity Fair, Hollywood Calling, February 8th to July 26th. Vanity Fair, Hollywood Calling features photographic portraiture and multimedia installations that capture the magic and glamour of the film and television industry's major players from the last four decades. The exhibition is a look at the Hollywood stars, the parties, and the power brokers through the distinctive lens of Vanity Fair, the most widely celebrated journalistic arbiter of Hollywood power and personality. The new exhibition at Annenberg Space for Photography, 2000 Avenue of the Stars, Los Angeles, California. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.